Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Dr. Nishi Rawat, MD, MBA, Senior Vice President at Appriss Health and co-founder of Open Beds. She is a physician and healthcare services researcher trained in critical care and emergency medicine and on the faculty at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She has worked on issues involving behavioral health as well as critical care. And Dr. Rawat has worked with the National Institute of Drug Abuse to develop technology to service providers in addressing the opioid epidemic. Open Beds is implemented around the country and was recently acquired by Appriss, where Dr. Rawat now leads strategy in the healthcare sector. Well, welcome, Nishi, and thank you for joining us on Harlow on Healthcare.
Thank you very much for having me, David.
So I'm interested to hear from you more about substance abuse and behavioral health needs and how they have most likely expanded given what we've all been experiencing this year.
Much of the country right now is isolated at home and increasingly so, given the recent infection rate, hospitalizations, number of deaths. From an economic standpoint, as you know, unemployment is at an all-time high, and we don't see economic recovery in sight at present. So not surprisingly, these conditions are detrimental to our mental health. The CDC actually surveyed about 5,000 people over the summer. So this is earlier in the pandemic, around June. And they found that about 40% of people said that they were suffering from a mental health condition. So this is anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress, substance use. And of those people using substances, 13% reported that they were using more of the substances. So we know, at least from these numbers, that people's mental health, that it's deteriorating. Beyond that, you know, the CDC recently released numbers showing that the overdose rate for all substances, that's increased from January to January, right? So it was increasing prior to the pandemic, but there are early data to suggest that the pandemic may have resulted in more overdoses as well, or at least there have been more overdoses during the time of the pandemic. And we'll know more about that as more data roll in, but there are no positive signs at present, it seems.
Sure. And even before the pandemic, in previous years, we've heard about a reduction in life expectancy that many have attributed to the opioid epidemic, at least in part. So that is certainly cause for concern as you see additional issues turning up in the course of the pandemic.
That's right, David. And, you know, I don't remember the details. I believe it was two economists who published this work. I believe it's Caucasian males in particular. Their life expectancy has been curbed in part due to the use of substances, opioids, along with alcohol. Yeah, that's right.
So, of course, the $64,000 question or whatever metric we use these days is, what do we do about it? How have we addressed these issues historically, and what can we do now? And is technology some sort of saving grace for us in the current environment?
You know, it's interesting, right? Because historically, we have not addressed the treatment needs for SUD. And by we, I mean, I'm referring to the medical care system and physicians in particular. In fact, some people perceive us, again, physicians, that's what I'm referring to, as being part of the problem, right? Because of historic uncontrolled prescribing of opioids. I remember as a physician myself training in East Baltimore, being told that one could not, or being taught rather, that one could not become addicted to opioids. right? That that wasn't possible. And the disconnect between what I was being trained to understand and what I was seeing on the ground. But now, you know, we're much more informed as physicians. We're prescribing opioids much more judiciously, right? We are prescribing non-opioid pain treatment more often. And we also have much better tools, so including the prescription monitoring database and systems like OpenBeds to refer people to assessment and treatment. So, you know, there's that prescribing piece that we historically didn't do well, right? And then in terms of behavioral health treatment, again, as medical care practitioners, we tend to treat the medical conditions alone, right? Because that's what we know best. And because of a lack of behavioral health knowledge, like I said, and difficulties in finding behavioral health treatment in general, we don't always assess and refer people to treatment that they need. A striking statistic is as follows. Only 10% of people who suffer from opioid misuse get evidence-based treatment, specifically medication-assisted treatment and behavioral health counseling. That's an awful statistic, right? That's shameful. In fact, there was a study that was done at Hopkins, I think it was over a year ago now in West Virginia, that looked at people who'd suffered from an overdose. They were in the emergency department. Thankfully, they were alive. But around, I think, 10 to 11% of them, after overdosing, got referred appropriately to medication-assisted treatment and counseling. So all this to say, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. But luckily, that piece I was talking about earlier, as physicians not having the knowledge, I think training is better now. It's part of core training now, behavioral health. So that's better. But like I said, I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to better integrate behavioral health with medical care.
Right. I mean, for years, it's been this sort of dual track kind of system.
Right.
And folks are diverted out of the traditional healthcare system into this sort of parallel universe. And I think we've done a lot of things where we think we're helping things along, and maybe they have in pockets. And I'm thinking of even things like drug courts and prescription drug management programs, which I'd be interested in your perspective on those two and maybe some other sorts of interventions, you know, sort of what has worked in the past, what hasn't worked in the past, what are we able to learn from today? Are we learning from successes in the past, or are we learning only from failures in the past?
You know, my opinion is that it takes a village, right? This siloing of healthcare and behavioral health care, siloing of homeless care, of veterans care, of caring for individuals in the criminal justice system, I think that that's probably hurt us the most. And the work that's being done now to break down these silos, have everyone work together, right? I think that that is what's going to carry us forward and really make an impact, David. Again, it takes a village, and to date, we've been trying to address the epidemic within our silos, and that hasn't worked. But I do think that these cross-silo initiatives are effective, right? We're mm-hmm. seeing results and are gaining traction as a result.
Right. So can you sketch out for us sort of how do you get from that view to sort of the beginnings, the germination of the idea for OpenBeds? And then from there, how is OpenBeds taken root and addressed in some way the issues that we're talking about?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, this was a big pain point of mine, trying to get people into acute inpatient psychiatric care, substance use disorder treatment from either the emergency department or the intensive care unit. So I was seeing a lot of people suffering from overdoses. We would put them on a breathing machine. If they survived, then we would take them off the breathing machine. And then, quite frankly, David, we would send them home. Right. And I remember this one kid, 16 years old, he'd overdosed. He was better. I was about to discharge him home. And his parents said, "We're not taking him home. What are you doing?" Right? He's going to end up back here if he's lucky, or he's going to be dead. And so you need to help us find treatment. And that was just so hard. I had a social worker at the time who would help, but quite frankly, she would just hand people a list of treatment providers and have them fend for themselves to try and find treatment, right? That's not right. Then they got rid of her. And so then it was me handing people a piece of paper, right? Because it, so anyway, all this to say that it was really challenging. I didn't feel as though I was doing right by people by sending them home. And then, you know, my job's done. I put the Band-Aid on the medical issue. I wanted to be able to do more. And so that was the beginning of Open Beds. And so what we do is we work with what we call conveners. And a convener can be a state government. It can be a payer. It can be a health system. And we work with them to set up these behavioral networks such that people who refer into behavioral health in a high volume way, right? So individuals who work within drug courts, social workers, case managers, and emergency departments, crisis lines, right? The operators who work those lines, they can see availability, capacity of inpatient and outpatient treatment resources across the region, right? They can then use one of our decision support tools to figure out what's the right type of treatment or level of treatment, mental health, substance use disorder treatment, for my client or patient. They can send a referral, communicate back and forth, figure out the logistics, close the loop, you know, find out whether or not their client showed up for an assessment or treatment. And then all the while people are using our system, we passively collect data at the regional level as well as at the local level around capacity, utilization, whether people are falling through the cracks, and if so, why? Is it because of a specific payment type? And we feed these data back to the convener, for example, a state government, and then they can say, okay, this is a gap that we need to address, right? And we're going to do that now with X amount of money, or this is working, right? Let's do more of that. States, payers, health systems don't have granular data right now. And so our system helps give them the data to improve their processes and care delivery in general.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is Nishi Rawat, Senior Vice President at Appriss Health, co-founder of Open Beds. The next question that I'd like to sort of explore with you is the question of where we go from here. Today, as we are speaking, every business, or many businesses across the country, are turning their attention to address the pandemic in one way or another. And I understand that you are doing the same. And I'm wondering if you could explain what approach you are taking to turn the technology that you've built for Open Beds to address issues around COVID-19.
I mentioned that I struggle to get my patients into behavioral health treatment. I also sometimes struggle to get my patients to tertiary and quaternary care services. So I'm Canadian, David. And to stay in this country, following my residency and fellowship, I worked at a number of community and rural hospitals. And that was to fulfill my H-1B green card requirements. But I learned a lot working at these hospitals. And it's interesting because these hospitals tend to have ICUs, but they don't necessarily have the services to support an intensive care unit to take care of very sick people. So I was probably transferring out 1 in 5 patients that I was seeing either the emergency department or assessing on the floors of the hospital. That meant that I was calling around, checking on bed availability, ICU bed availability, service availability at these tertiary and quaternary care centers, right? So I had the 8 phone numbers, fax numbers of these hospitals memorized, and people died in my hands. And it was hard because I'll never know whether those people died because I couldn't get them to definitive care in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. And that was really, really hard. And what's harder now is that it's still happening, right? I read about this daily now. You've got ED physicians in rural Texas who've got COVID patients on ventilators, multi-system organ failure, and they're trying to get them out to tertiary and quaternary care centers because they don't, again, have the clinicians, the services, the beds at their hospital to take care of these very sick individuals. And they struggle to transfer out their patients because either, you know, they don't have, there aren't beds available, or they don't have the relationships, right? These transfers happen because of informal hospital and physician relationships for the most part. And we know that these problems in terms of getting people out to the care that they need, this contributes to disparities in care, right? People who are treated at tertiary care centers for COVID, they do better. We know that now. And African-American people, Latino people, people living in rural areas are suffering more because they can't access high quality care, right? So because of that, we finagled our behavioral health platform to track critical resources, specifically critical beds, key personnel, and vital equipment. And we do this real time, and we submit it to the federal HHS Protect system. So I don't know if you're aware of this, but right now, all the hospitals across the U.S. are mandated to submit about 140-ish data elements. And their submission of these data, it's tied to CMS participation, right? And it takes anywhere between 2 to 5 hours, depending on who you talk to manually collect and report out on all of these data elements related to bed availability, COVID cases, now flu, and some other elements. So it's a huge burden on these hospitals. And these data are not real time. They're required to submit most of the data elements once a day manually. Not only are the data not real time, but they're also not defined in a granular way. So in sum, the data that they're submitting, it's labor intense for the hospitals, also the states who are sometimes sending the data on behalf of the hospitals. And the data don't really reflect operational and clinical processes because they're not defined properly. The elements are not defined properly, and they're not real time. So in any event, we developed this system that's automated this reporting process, and it's live now in 124 hospitals across North Carolina. And, you know, I would argue that the data coming out of North Carolina are probably the most actionable relative to the data across the country right now that are coming from other states. Again, because we're getting an hourly feed from hospitals, from the majority of the hospitals in North Carolina, and we've defined those data in a very granular way.
That's great. I know the reporting systems, at least around the sort of COVID inventory of resources and availability, that has sort of flip-flopped between CDC and HHS Central and back again, maybe, has just been, as you say, very manual, very labor-intensive. I know some systems have one or more FTEs dedicated to this information gathering and reporting function, which seems nuts in this day and age, but it sounds like you've found a way to rationalize at least some of that.
Yeah, and David, I didn't even mention that the piece that addresses the disparities in care, the patient transfer issue, we've created a patient movement module as part of this critical resource tracking system to help people in need of access to ICU beds and a higher level of care get there. So it serves as a clinical tool as well. And it provides transparency regarding bed availability and as a mechanism to communicate across hospitals. So if I'm at a rural hospital, I can communicate with a tertiary care hospital or a coordinating entity that's assigned by the state to say, look, I've got this patient who's in dire need of an ICU bed and a higher level of care.
Right. So you can arrange a transfer in a systematized way, as opposed to relying on personal relationships with someone at a tertiary care facility.
Yeah, and calling a dozen places and waiting for them to call you back while you're trying to take care of a very sick patient. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's certainly a step in the right direction. I used to do a bunch of work in EMS, and just the transfer work and the paperwork involved in that was just sort of overwhelming on all fronts. I wanted to sort of go back and talk more about the substance abuse side of things and ask you about the consumer-facing portal that you've developed as well. How does that fit in with your system? What's the functionality there? What's the theory behind having a consumer-facing portal?
Yeah, sure. We launched our provider or clinician-facing portal first. And we took a good amount of time to develop and launch the public-facing system. It was really important to me that we get this right. You know, as a clinician, it's taken me a lot of time and effort to turn my head around the types of behavioral health treatment out there, right? How it all works. And I really wanted to provide people with guidance to help themselves find high quality treatment or help their loved ones find high quality treatment, right? But it's so hard, right? Care is so fragmented and it's difficult to understand the different levels of treatment. What do I need? What am I paying for? So in any event, the first thing we did is we built this addiction treatment and needs assessment with the American Society for Addiction Medicine, as well as a nonprofit called Shatterproof. And what that does is it allows you to figure out what is the right type of treatment or level of treatment that I need or that my loved one needs, right? And so that's the first step. And then beyond that, people can then search for treatment using our treatment locator functionality at the public facing portal, right? So all of our state systems feed into this public facing portal. You can use the decision support tool. You can then search for treatment. Like I said, all of the organizations have been vetted by the state government. So you're sure that there's a certain care quality standard that's being met. And then beyond just searching, you can actually reach out to a treatment provider and say, look, this is who I am. This is what I need. Am I appropriate for your services? And you can do that in an anonymous way, or you can ask them to call you or email you back. So this is, in my opinion, a way for people to make a more informed decision, right? Find quality care and then actually socialize the prospect of treatment in a digital way.
So that's certainly a boon for an engaged patient or a patient with an engaged family member or other caregiver. Certainly better than being handed a sheet of names and numbers. The question that comes to mind is, what about the folks who maybe don't have the ability to use such a tool, who are in extremis or are just not able to take that step, don't have the self-awareness or don't have the technical ability to do that? How many folks do you think are helped by this proportion? You know, what proportion of the whole are helped by a tool like this? Is this a sort of a digital divide kind of problem, or am I overthinking it?
No, you're not. You know, I don't know what the proportion is, but I can tell you, in order to serve those who are perhaps not as digitally savvy or are in extremis, we've actually got a support line there. So you can call our phone number 24/7 and get help in finding treatment. And then if you're an extremist, if you're in crisis, we'll do a warm handoff to the appropriate state crisis line. So we've actually got the state crisis lines listed there pretty prominently at the state specific search pages. And then if you call our support line again, we'll hand you off if necessary.
Great. So to wrap things up, I wanted to ask, If you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what's one thing in healthcare that you would either hope or expect to find has changed dramatically?
Yeah, my goodness, I've got a list, David.
We all have hopes.
I don't even know
where
to begin. My goodness. I think I would like to see a decrease in the cost of care overall for people here in the U.S., along with greater transparency about the cost of care. Those two things go hand in hand, right? And maybe it's my Canadian roots, but nothing pains me more than people not being able to afford a decent quality of medical and behavioral health care, or avoiding care altogether because they can't afford it. I just had a baby, right? It was exorbitantly expensive, David, and the bills keep coming. I have a medical degree. I have a business degree, right? But I still struggle to decipher the bills.
So we can't make head or tail of those bills, right?
No, no. And I'm finding mistakes, exaggerations all of the time. I have spent a lot of time on the phone with the insurance company as well as with the hospitals, clinics, trying to resolve these issues. So I don't understand how people without a clinical and business background, interpret these bills and understand what they're paying for. Now, and why is it so expensive? Why do two hospitals 20 miles apart and in the same health system charge vastly different prices? How do they get away with that? So in any event, it's timely, right, this topic, because again, we're seeing disparities in care right now with certain communities dying more from COVID, in part because they're afraid to seek care because it's too expensive, right? And people, again, as I mentioned earlier, because they don't have access to high quality care. So this is something that I'd like to see resolved in 5 years, more transparency, lower cost of care. I'll tell you one more story. I fell off my bike in Bulgaria 2 years ago, right? And had a very badly injured knee, couldn't walk for 2 weeks. My husband is Bulgarian. We go there every summer. I received excellent, timely care for pennies. I mean, it was less than a dollar. I was blown away, right? The orthopedic surgeon assessed me within 24 hours. In the same building, I got imaging, interpretation of the imaging, cleaning of my wound, and then a custom brace. This was all within 2 hours, David, right? So why isn't this type of care available in the U.S. at a reasonable price point, right? I can go on and on here. So this is probably the subject of another podcast. But yeah, that's what I'd like to see improved.
Well, thank you very much. That is an inspiring vision of the future. Thank you for taking the time today.
Oh, thank you for having me, David.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.